Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the book they have written, are in the process of writing, or intend to write someday. I've got a number of folks joining me this morning in the studio. My new co-host and producer, Andy Lowe. Andy has his own BRX show called Renegade Radio. Andy runs things in the Alpharetta studio, and right now you're trying to figure out where that ghost came from, right?
Yeah, we've got ghosts in the machines around here lately. I guess we got to call Ghostbusters or whatever, get Dan Aykroyd and the crew over here, fix some things. I'm glad we got Stone in the studio this morning, because now I can say, hey, this is what I've been telling you.
Yeah, well, hey, you know, I was going to say my original co-host and producer, Stone Payton, has joined me today as well. And are you ready for this, Stone? He is a vital cog at Business Radio X with his own show, High Velocity Radio.
I love being called Vital Cog, and I am going to have that badge made and wear it on my lapel.
Good. It's good to have you back. Also in the studio with me are Emil Paradis and Betsy Ray Miner. Emil is a partner in the Referral Institute, a program that guides individuals in becoming certified and highly effective networkers. I've had Emil as a guest on previous shows. He is insightful with comments, and he asks great questions, but more importantly for me, he's an esteemed friend and colleague. And Betsy Ray Miner is affiliated with Right Choice Services. She is a writing coach, an editor, and also a newly inked certified networker. And now for the real guest of the show, calling in from California, where the sun has probably just begun to break above the horizon, is Dr. Ivan Meisner. He's the founder of BNI, the largest business networking organization in the world, and a senior partner with the Referral Institute. Good morning and welcome, Dr. Meisner.
Good morning.
It's such a delight to have you with us. Thank you for making the time.
No, it's my pleasure.
So you are a business, you fit all the categories. You're a business leader, you're an entrepreneur, you're a professional, you're an author, and not only are you an author, but you're an honest-to-God, authentic New York Times best-selling author. And at the end of 2011, your new book came to market, Business Networking and Sex, Not What You Think. What triggered the idea for researching and writing business networking and sex?
Well, it was really my co-authors, Frank DeRaffley and Hazel Walker, who were talking about doing a book on gender and networking. And that's what the Not What You Think part is about. The book is about the difference between men and women and how they network. We originally thought about the title Business Networking and Gender, but wait, can you hear the crickets? Nobody would buy that book. So we went with Business Networking and Sex, but it was Frank and Hazel's idea. They wanted to do something based on what they had seen take place in the many, many, many networking meetings that they'd been to.
I found it fascinating reading it and the way it's set up. You introduced the topic or the idea for each chapter, and then you have a little bit of he said and she said, and the contrast is utterly amazing. What has been the reaction in the marketplace, in the business world so far?
Well, it's been good. I think the title sometimes scares business people because, you know, I mean, I'm going to give you an example. There was somebody at a hospital, it was a Catholic hospital, and he's reading the book, and one of the nuns walked up to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, but I don't think you should be reading a book about sex here at the hospital."
And oops, you know, I was like, oops.
Okay. No, sister, it's about it's about gender. But he just said okay and put it away. It's gone over well. We hit number one in business on Amazon.com last month, and continues to do well.
That's great. What was the impact you hoped that the book would have? What did you want to bring to our attention?
Well, I think a couple of things. First, we wanted to have a book that had some hard data on it, not just what we thought was happening between men and women while they network, but some real hard data and content. And that's why Frank and Hazel asked me to participate in this, because I was really leading the charge and doing the survey. The survey is a survey of 12,000 business people on every populated continent. And so we wanted to go into this, and you said it, I open up every chapter, and I do the survey says, and I talk about the data. And I do it in a way, I try to do it in a way that's interesting, but it's also gender neutral. And here's what the data says. and this is what it means, without taking gender side. Then Frank and Hazel do the he says and she says, and they're anything but gender neutral. They come right at it from their own perspective. So we wanted to have, and then we also wanted to add in our experience, because between the three of us, we have decades of experience in networking. And so taking the data and adding our own experience and our own perspective, I think made a very, very unique book.
I would agree with that. It drew me back to my days when I studied social psychology, and that was a few years ago, decades ago, but that whole gender concept. And one of the stories that is told in the book that I welcome your comment on, it the pseudonyms are Jacqueline and Paul, and Paul wanted to tighten up the membership, if you will, and get rid of some deadwood, and he thought they could begin with a 21-year-old woman, Jacqueline, who, after all, what did she know? And she hadn't been in business for very long, and what was it, about 3 weeks, 3 months later, she brought Paul the biggest multi-million-dollar referral he'd ever had. Did you find it? Do you run into stuff like that? Are you aware of things like that happening in various groups of not old enough, not enough gray hair?
Yeah.
Get rid of them.
Yeah, with some regularity, actually.
Oh.
The one thing I would tell people is don't underestimate the context that other people have. We make judgments about people when we meet them, and we assume that they have a certain set of context or they don't. And sometimes you're just completely shocked by the people that someone might know or be connected with. And in this particular case, what you're referring to is a person who is like, not only is she young, not only is she fairly new in business, but as I recall, this is Frank's story in the book, and as I recall, she was a cosmetics consultant. And so he just didn't take that serious as a business. And it turns out that her business was actually pretty successful. And she had unbelievable contacts, and she made a referral that was, as you said, a huge referral. It was probably one of the biggest. Well, the gentleman who got the referral said it's the biggest referral he ever got in his life. And the irony was that he was trying to block her from being in the group. He tried to, we don't need this kind of inexperience in our group. Ends up getting the biggest referral of his life.
Dr. Meisner, I wondered if there was anything in the data you collected that surprised you?
Yeah, there was so much in the data that surprised me. Starting with, it may sound a little opposite of what you're saying, but starting with some of the data wasn't that vastly different between men and women. That surprised me. There were some aspects of the objective data where I would say, the book from John Graham, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, I looked at it and I was like, Mars and Venus aren't two different planets. They're two different cities in the same county. That the difference between them was, reasonably close on the objective data. It was statistically significant. There was a difference, and it was statistically significant, which means that it would be replicable. It has a 95% chance or better of being replicable. So it was significant, but the difference wasn't gigantic. That surprised me. Then what surprised me next was the open-ended questions, because there the open-ended questions were the feedback from men and women were light years apart. There Mars and Venus were two different solar systems in the galaxy. I mean, they were way, way apart from each other. And so what we first struggled with was, why was the data reasonably close in many areas, but so far apart in the way people discussed it? That would be one of many, many things that I would have to say surprised me.
Dr. Meisner, this is Stone Payton. Many of our listeners, particularly on this program, are aspiring authors, and many of them would like very much to write a book that includes hard data, like you've done. Yeah. What tips, if any, do you have to offer to get people, a critical mass of people, to be willing and able to participate in data collection?
How long is this show? there's so many things that I would say about a survey. One of the reasons that Frank and Hazel brought me in is they started to do the survey. And your primary question is, how do you get people to take the survey? But there's a couple things before that. Just constructing a survey is an art. And they started to put something together, and it was a disaster because they didn't have experience doing surveys. So you want to bring in somebody who has some experience doing surveys, because I guarantee you that the way you write the question will influence the results you get. You have to pick your questions very carefully if you're trying to get unbiased results. You also need to test your survey. So before you send it out, you got to test it, because you're always surprised by some of the results. And by surprised, I mean not not necessarily the answers, but I mean not that the answers surprise you, but that there were answers you didn't expect and didn't include in the survey. For example, you might have an open-ended question or a question that gives a choice of multiple choices and then other, and then you get an other very consistent response that's, you know, that's a BFO. It's a blinding flash of the obvious. And you think, well, why didn't I include that in the list of choices rather than put it in other? So by doing a test, you're able to alter your survey to make it more effective. And so that's the next thing that you need to do. Then you really need, if you want to have really good data, you need to hire a statistician.
Yeah.
You know, I can work my way around statistics. I understand SPSS programming, which is the statistical packages for the social sciences. But you really need to hire somebody who's truly an expert. Because one of the things I learned early on when I was working on my doctoral degree is if you torture the data long enough, it'll confess to anything.
I know that one too. Go ahead.
That's a great point. I'd like to ask a question here, Dr. Meisner, because you can do exactly that. Statistics are so manipulable, and data can be told in any format you want to. If somebody is writing a book and they're looking to get information out, you know, kind of what's your advice to them? Do they put these surveys out and then try to write the story based on the data that comes back? Or do they start with the story and try to look for data that validates what they're trying to tell?
Well, I think a little bit of both. You go into it with a hypothesis or two. You know, you have some ideas of what's going to happen, and we certainly did. Let me answer the rest of that, but because I didn't really finish your first question, which was then how do you get the survey out? That was your previous question. I was kind of leading up to that. One of the things that you want to do when you want to get that survey out is tell everybody and their mother how to get to it. So we contacted every chamber we could think of, every women's business organization, our friends, our associates. We certainly used the BNI network, and we put it out there, and the survey was out online for at least 2 years. So we gave it time, and we sent it to everybody and their mother. And every time we sent out a mailing or an emailing, you know, it would spike in terms of the results. So you just got to put it out there, and you got to leave it out there long enough. You need, depends on the kind of survey you're doing, but you want at least a few hundred responses to have any chance of statistical validity. We had 12,000, so it was a lot of chance for that.
That's the last
question, which I didn't answer.
The last question is just about the data. Do you collect the data and then write the story, or do you look for data that justifies the story you're trying to tell?
Well, that's called a hypothesis. And so, you know, we went into it with at least one hypothesis. There was one thing that we expected. And you can, you know, you can either find that to be true or not true when you come in with a hypothesis. And one of the hypotheses we had, probably the most important, was related to the VCP process of networking: visibility, credibility, profitability. And we understood that in the VCP process, it starts with visibility in networking. You have to be visible. People have to know who you are and what you do. Then you establish credibility, where people know who you are, they know what you do, and they know you're good at it. And then it's chronological. Then you move to profitability, where people know who you are, they know what you do, they know you're good at it, and they're willing to pass you referrals on an ongoing reciprocal basis. So we went into this thinking that women would be more likely than men to go from visibility to credibility, to get caught up in credibility and not ask for the sale. And this is based on our experiences, not based on the data. That was our hypothesis. And that men would be more likely to go from visibility right to profitability. Hi, my name's Ivan. Let's do business. By the way, we call that premature solicitation, which you don't want to say fast three times, so it'll get you in trouble.
No. So, I like it, though.
That was our hypothesis going into it. And so we asked questions to determine you know, whether it would play out to be true, and it did. Women were slightly more likely to get caught up in credibility and focus on the relationship first and the business second, and men were more likely than women to focus on the business first and the relationship second, and to, you know, focus more on getting right to the profitability. There were a number of other questions that we asked that also led us to prove that hypothesis. For the most part, though, we let the data write the book. With a few exceptions like that, it was the answers we got that determined what direction we went with the book, and we went in a completely different direction in some areas than what we expected.
I just, this is Emil. As I was listening to you talk, I was thinking back to the first book I read of yours, World's Best Known Marketing Secret, and the delineation of women's networking groups as a separate model in networking. Did you? I guess the statistics or the data kind of supported that observation that women do network differently within those kinds of groups.
Well, I think women, and I talked about this in World's Best Known, I think women are really responsible for the type of networking organizations that exist today. Because, you know, when I wrote that book, it was in 1994, it was published. And at that point, there were virtually no books on networking. If you do a literature search, you'll find virtually no books out there on word-of-mouth marketing or business networking. And so I was really kind of... tried to do a historical perspective. How did we get here, where networking has become so important? And one of the reasons for it was the women's business organizations, because they were unable. Many women's business organizations started because they were unable to join the good old boys groups, you know, which at that time, some of the most predominant ones were the service clubs, which are now open to both men and women. But in the 80s, up until the late 80s, they were for men only. And so, you know, women started creating their own networking groups, and they did it from scratch. And, of course, if you're new in business, service to the community is important, but the truth is what you really need is more business. And so they created networks that fit their need, and that their need as a new business person was to generate business. And so they did a network in a different form than men did. It was more focused on doing business rather than socializing and, you know, serving the community, which sounds unusual, but that's the way it kind of played out. And so business organizations, networking organizations that exist today exist, I think, to a great deal because of the influence of women's business groups in the 80s and early 90s.
Dr. Meisner, I have written all of my books by myself except for my most recent one, which was collaborative. And Vanessa, with whom I collaborated, has written all her books collaboratively. You have done both. What do you see as the experience, as the major difference between writing a book all by yourself and writing collaboratively?
Well, there's quite a few differences. You know, when you write a book by yourself, you are the master of the product. You know, it goes in the direction you want it to go, which could be good or bad. You know, if you have a really clear vision and that vision happens to hit the mark with people, then it can be a home run. But it's easier to write a book on your own. On the other hand, one of the things, because I've done both, one of the things I really like about collaborating is that it gives you an infusion of new ideas. It gives you an opportunity to discuss and debate and mold concepts collaboratively. And that's definitely what happened with business networking and sex. I probably had more brainstorming discussion sessions. Okay, there may have been a couple of glasses of wine involved in some of those. But
okay, we like that.
But we had more brainstorming sessions with that book than any book I've ever done. I think the downside to doing a collaborative book can be, you know, it's like any partnership. There are some that play out well and some that don't. You know, writing with some people can be problematic, especially if they want to go in a different direction than you want to go. When all, you know, said and done, you got to make a choice, and that can create tension. Also, the marketing of the book. I have found that that's where I have the biggest problems with co-authors. You know, they think that a book is going to get written and all of a sudden they're going to be a gazillionaire and everybody on the planet's going to know who they are and what they do, and that they don't really have to do a lot of work. Well, what I found after I did my first book was the hardest part of the book process was not writing the book.
It was the marketing.
It was selling the damn thing. Yeah. The marketing.
Yeah.
That was the hardest part. And as much as I tell some of my co-authors, they don't get that until the book comes out. And then they're just shocked at how hard it is.
Oh, it's a rude awakening. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, that was the surprise, wasn't it?
It was a big surprise for me when I did the first one. And Emil, just for the record, that was my second one. My first book was so bad that I couldn't sell it.
Oh.
It was called Networking for Success. I wrote it in 1987, and I think it sold about 20 copies. I'm exaggerating a little, but it didn't sell very many. And it wasn't distributed in bookstores. It was a self-published book. But World's Best Known Marketing Secret now, I think, is about 150,000 copies, and it's in 5 languages now, so it's done a little better.
Well, gosh, Ivan, I would like to get a copy of that to complete my collection.
Yeah, I don't think you do.
How many books have you written in total, then?
16.
Oh, my goodness. And how many of those have been on the New York Times bestseller list?
Well, about 10 of them have made a bestsellers list. I think 3 have made the New York Times bestsellers list. Okay. The three definitely have made the New York Times bestsellers list.
I like the way you kind of differentiated there, Dr. Meisner, because I have people ask me if I have a bestseller, and I always say absolutely, and they said, which list? And I said, the bookstore in my hometown. And you know, and they usually laugh, and that's just it. You got to be very careful when you read that somebody has a best-selling book. You got to ask them where. That's why it's really an honor to have a real, honest to God New York Times bestseller author on the show today. And that's great. Yeah. And I noted that you did say that you made the Amazon number one list with business books last month or so.
Yeah, it was number 2 overall. The Hunger Games kept us from number 1 overall, but we were number 1 in business.
Oh, well, that's great.
Could I ask a question right here?
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, did that happen just by accident, Ivan, or was there something that happened to make that happen?
Business books rarely happen in terms of bestsellers by accident. You know, fiction books might, but fiction books outsell the nonfiction, you know, many times over. And so to have a nonfiction book hit a bestseller list on Amazon, especially to hit number 2, doesn't happen by accident. There was a strategy that was employed that we'd been working on for 6 months that involved social media and pushing sales from my personal network through Amazon rather than direct sales. Because, you know, I'll sell many, many, many more books than what goes through the bookstores because I have a platform. The problem is any books, I'll tell you what my number one selling book in the world is. It's not on any bestsellers list. Oh. My number one best-selling book has probably sold now close to 1 million copies, but it's not sold in bookstores. So it's never going to be on any bestsellers list.
And which book is that?
Giver's Gain, the BNI story. Every BNI member, when they join,
right.
gets a copy. And there's probably close to 1 million copies now. Certainly 1 million in print, probably 1 million that have been sold when somebody joins, they get one.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't go through the bookstores. So any books that are sold through platforms never hit any bestsellers lists.
But the money is just as good, isn't it?
It is, but when you sell it for about 50 cents a book, it's not that good.
Oh, well. Stone, you
have
something.
Maybe 75 cents a book. We want to make sure that that book, to me, that book, it's more important to get it in people's hands than to make a lot of money on it. Because it's the traditions, it's the core values of the organization. And so we want every member in BNI to have in their possession the core values and the traditions of the organization so that they can be a better member.
Doctor, this is Stone Payton again. With your permission, I'm going to shift gears just a little bit and ask you a question that is very relevant to me, but I hope that it has some appropriate application to the rest of our listeners. As I understand it, you have some 6,000-plus BNI chapters. My business partner and I have 3 studios. We have every reason to believe that we can replicate our business, and I wonder if you might have some counsel to offer in terms of replicating a concept that's working, and maybe you could express it with one or two do's and one or two don'ts, but would certainly appreciate any advice you might have on that topic.
Well, the first thing, which is really difficult for entrepreneurs, is to understand the importance and learn how to delegate effectively. And one of the first key elements of effective delegation is to delegate not only responsibility but authority. So as you open additional locations, you have to give authority to people within certain guidelines. Here's the framework. Here are the boundaries. You can't step outside these boundaries. But within these boundaries, you have some authority. You have to have both responsibility and authority. And what tends to happen in delegation is that you delegate responsibility but not authority. So they have to keep coming back and asking you for everything. So that's I think, a really important aspect. I believe in franchising, although the barrier to entry to franchise now is becoming extreme because of state regulation. It's very difficult for somebody to franchise now, but franchising is a powerful way to build an organization because you literally have owner-operators. They are, in effect, junior partners in a way, and not legally, but in a way they're sort of junior partners to the enterprise. They own a piece of the enterprise. So those are two really big do's that I would recommend in opening multiple locations. A couple of things to steer away from is it's easy to not create systems where you have accountability. So you want to make sure to have some levels of accountability. Use what are called KSFs, or key success factors, things that absolutely identify whether the unit is being successful or not being successful. And the lack of that, which is real common to not create that as you're doing, as you have just a handful of locations, will absolutely put a company out of business within a few years because you don't have any measuring tool to determine success. Is that a few good ideas for you?
It most certainly is. Thank you.
And I'll piggyback off of Stone's question about do's and don'ts. You mentioned that women don't always close the sale, and you mentioned that men are guilty of what you called premature solicitation. Can you suggest some ways that women can do better and men can do better?
Yeah, first of all, we're not telling you to, if you're a woman, to try and act like a man, or if you're a man trying to act like a woman, but to recognize that men and women, as a rule, there are some differences. Now, as I talk about some of these differences, your listeners are going to be going, that's not me. I don't do that. Okay, so I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the average man or woman, and there are averages. The problem, and the averages came out pretty clearly that you see some patterns, but not every man behaves that way, and not every woman behaves that way. As a matter of fact, we talk about that in the book. We call it The Exception Becomes the Perception. But that there are tendencies. So men are a little more likely than women to, to just try to go right for the kill and, get right to profitability. Hazel likes to say, ladies, we've dated those men. They're going right for profitability. So the women have a tendency to, to kind of get caught up in the process of the sale. So my suggestion is women need to, when they're talking to a man, be a little more direct in their business. To actually not steer away from some of the relational kinds of conversation that they might have if they were talking to another woman. And that a man needs to do the flip of that. Man needs to be a little bit more relational. They have a tendency to go right into they kind of go name, rank, and serial number. My name is so-and-so, I do such and such, and we help people do this. Rather than have more of a relational conversation. There was a woman in the survey in the open-ended responses, and we had 1,000 open-ended responses to our survey. And one woman said, when I talk to a woman versus talking to a man, it's so much different because when I talk to a man, he just gets right to the point and right to the business. When I talk to a woman, the first question she might ask is, how did you get to this organization? Do you know somebody here? And she'd say, yeah, I have a friend who's a member of this. Well, how do you know so-and-so? And where did you meet, and how long have you known? And it becomes more of a relational conversation as opposed to a transactional conversation. And one of the things that we learned in the book is that relational beats transactional in terms of the amount of business generated. So whether you're a man or a woman, the relational approach to networking is more powerful. But women do it a little more and a little more effectively than men.
One of the concepts that you mention in the book and go on about is that there is a difference between networking wide and networking deep. Is that somewhat reflective of what you just were talking about, or how would you describe that?
Yeah, I would. The wide probably is a little more transactional, the deep is a little more relational. If your network is a mile wide and an inch deep, it will not be very powerful. You'll not have a powerful personal network. You have a lot of visibility, but not a lot of business. And so you want to have a network that is both wide and deep. Let me give you a sort of a metaphor to put this in perspective. I'm in Southern California, and I don't know if you on the news you see every year in Southern California we have what are called the Santa Ana winds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's big winds that come in. And if you ever see on the news of the damage that's done, there's always trees that are knocked over, and they're on somebody's house or on somebody's car. Take a good look at the trees. Almost every single time, they are eucalyptus trees that are not native to Southern California. Okay? Mm. They're not native to Southern California. They're eucalyptus trees, and they're a certain type of eucalyptus tree that has a root system that is very wide, but it doesn't go deep into the ground. So what happens is when the Santa Ana winds hit these trees, and they're huge. I mean, they're like 50, 70 feet tall. They're huge trees. And it'll knock them right over. And the reason for that is they have a root system that's very wide and doesn't go very deep. Now, apply that to networking. If you have a network that is wide but not deep, when you get hit with tough economic times, boom, it falls right over. So your network needs to be both broad and deep. You need to have a lot of visibility, but you also need with a certain number of people to have good, strong credibility in order to have a strong personal network.
You know, I think back over the 7 years that I've owned Right Choice Services and how I've been working and networking all along, and I'm going to plug Emil, not that he needs any, but I did go to his referral institute, and I really learned effective networking. And one of the things that I've experienced over the past 2 years is in these tough economic times, my business is growing and expanding beyond belief, and I'm convinced that it's because I learned to do that deep and wide, the visibility, the profitability, the credibility, and those are more than just terms. They work, but then you know that, don't you?
Well, yeah, I'd like to think that I do, but it's mostly, you know, through trial and error, because we don't teach this in colleges and universities. It's not taught in school. And so, you know, myself and a handful of other people have really kind of codified an industry, created an industry, because it's not being taught in school. And I find it very frustrating, and it was you know, challenging, because we kind of learned through trial and error on what works and what doesn't work.
Well, along that same line, one of the things that I often tell people that I fully appreciated from the process was learning that it's okay to say no, that this networking event or this networking group really isn't working for me, and so I really don't need to be a part of it and move on. That was so liberating.
Yeah, you know, there are many different kinds of networking groups out there. They all have strengths and weaknesses. My perspective on, you know, finding good networking groups is to find one that has accountability, but that's my perspective. And so other people want something that's a little more social. And so you got to find something that fits what you're looking for and what you need. And that does, it does vary. You know, people are being invited to networking groups all the time. You have to ask yourself, is this an opportunity or is this a distraction? And you want to look for opportunities and not distractions.
Well, speaking of those opportunities, and Dr. Majner, I'd like to ask you this, and Emil as well, feel free to jump in here. But, you know, you talk about tracking data points, I think, in your book on your networking. What are some of the data points that people should be paying attention to in their networking to realize if it's effective and moving them in the right direction, or if it's time for a change either to themselves and the way they're doing it or the venue in which they're doing it?
Well, and Emil can jump in on this as well. In the Referral Institute, he teaches a certified networker training program that uses some material out of a book I wrote called World's Best Known Marketing Secret, and it has what's called a networking scorecard. And so those are the data points that you want to measure. You want to measure the activities that are taking place. And I'll tell you, where I came up with the networking scorecard came from my experience as a consultant working with an insurance company and their one card system. And their one card system measured the cold calling process so that you knew that if you made X number of cold calls, you'd get Y number of discussions that would lead to Z number of appointments and sales. And so it was a process. And I started asking myself, can you do that same process with networking? And the answer was yes. But you have to measure a lot of different things, like how many networking groups are you going to? And you assign a score to that. How many networking groups am I going to? How many one-to-ones am I doing? How many referrals am I giving? And you measure that, and you're able to determine what it takes to be successful in the networking process. Anything you'd add to that, Emil?
Yeah. One of the things that really makes that start to have a great effect is observing who and where is working. So you have all these activities that you're tracking, and if you're starting to see the same name showing up, and it's really important to associate names with activities, particularly if you're keeping track of where business is being generated, where are you getting referrals, or where are you having an impact with somebody, and is it being returned? That's when you really start seeing activity paying off. We try to get activity level up first, and then we start to try to focus the activity levels, specific activities on specific individuals and groups so that you...
Yeah, that's a really good point. You oftentimes don't know where to drill down and focus unless you're measuring to begin with. And so the measuring process is just the first part of it. Then you have to really take that information and then drill down, just like Emil's saying.
Along the gender line, do you find that men are less honest in some of their self-scoring than women, perhaps?
Well, we didn't have any baseline to determine that, so I don't know the answer to that question. I think that when you have 12,000 respondents and it was roughly 6,000 of each, you're going to get such a big sample size that you're going to get some consistency that I think helps support the data as being as accurate as possible. Both men and women, men don't have a monopoly on fibbing. I think you're going to get it both ways.
You just answered a question that I had jotted down. That on page 116 in the book, there are 3 points. The first one is develop systems around your networking activities that include tracking. Point 2 is choose the right type of networking activities. And point 3 is automate your network so you can spend time working your network instead of just networking. And I was going to ask you to elaborate. So people who are listening to this on the MP3 need to back up and listen to what Dr. Meisner just said to get the answer to that. But it's in the book. So how's that for a plug for you in your book?
That's perfect. Thank you. Page 116.
Page 116 in the book called Business Networking and Sex, Not What You Think.
I think the next book needs to be Men Don't Have a Monopoly on Fibbing. I love that. That's a great working title for a book.
Well, do you have another book in the mind, on paper, in the files? What's the future hold?
There's one or two books. There's two books that I'm working on now. One is about behavior profiles. And Emil knows both of the people that I'm working on with these books. Don Lyons, who's probably one of the world's leading experts, probably is the world's leading expert on behavior profiles and referral marketing, those two things in conjunction. So understanding behavioral characteristics using programs like DISC, drive, influence, steadiness, compliance, that kind of thing. And applying that to a referral marketing process. She and I are working on a book along with Tony Alessandra on that. And then the next book is a book called Referrals for Life with Mike Macedonio. Mike helped me do the 4th edition of World's Best Known. And that's a book really aimed at, it's mostly storytelling about how people have created a business that have referrals for life. They've generated referrals for the rest of their life through the process that they've put in place.
Wow. I like the sound.
Those are the next two. I've been asked by the publisher to do a follow-up to Business Networking and Sex called Social Networking and Sex, and we might do that.
Yeah. Well, what advice or suggestions or encouragement would you give to other business leaders, professionals, and entrepreneurs about writing a book? I appreciated your saying earlier that writing's the easy part. It's the marketing that gets you every time. But what else would you share?
Well, you know, I think that writing a book is one of the best strategies to build a brand and to build recognition. Now, when I started writing, it was a much more complicated process. Getting published was really difficult. It's not quite so difficult anymore. I mean, the industry has changed dramatically. And so if you're interested in writing a book to become wealthy, do something else.
There you go.
Because unless you have a gigantic platform, people ask me all the time, wow, what's your secret? How do you push all your books now to the bestsellers list, at least to the Amazon bestsellers list? And I tell them, putting one of my books on the bestsellers list is easy. It's easy. I can push it to number one in business on Amazon easily. The tough part was building a platform of almost 200,000 people.
Yeah.
That's the tough part. You know, so if you build a platform of a couple hundred thousand people, you're gonna make that happen. So if you're trying to build your brand and your business, write a book. Because I learned years ago that the media, if you go to the media and say, hey, would you do an article on me, or would you do a television episode, you know, a little segment in your news show about BNI, they'd say, no, take an ad out. You know, we're not going to promote your business. But the media will interview any idiot with a book, and I have 16.
Okay, I'm encouraged by that. I really am. I like that.
So, well, it's true. I get more interviews on my books. Mm-hmm. Than I do for any other reason, for all other reasons combined. I get more interviews in my books. And when I'm doing the books, generally, somehow, some way, the host will ask about my business, BNI, or the Referral Institute. And I have a chance to talk a little bit about those while I'm talking about, you know, content, educational, informational content. Mm-hmm. And it's a real win-win for everyone. So I urge people to do a book. And if you can't, if you're not good at writing, hire a developmental editor, somebody who will take your writing and flesh it out. You know, record your content, talk into a microphone, and then give it to a developmental editor who will help flesh it out.
And I didn't pay you to say that, right?
No, absolutely did not. And you know what? I've used developmental editors. I can tell you, there was one book, and it's different than a ghostwriter. A ghostwriter basically puts in their own stuff to some extent.
That's right. Yeah.
Whereas a developmental editor is basically taking your content and putting it into the written word. And you can read a book, and Emil knows all three of us, Truth or Delusion. That was written by Mike Macedonio, Mike Garrison, and myself. And the entire book was done with a developmental editor. I don't think I ever typed more than a page of content.
Oh, my.
What it was all recordings.
Sure, sure.
And we brought in a guy who is very good at this, and we did hours and hours and hours of interviews. And we had a few articles that we gave as well, and he produced this book from the hundreds of hours of time that he spent interviewing us. Well, dozens of hours, anyway. And then when you read that book, and Emil, tell me if I'm wrong, you can read a piece of that book and say, that's Mike Garrison. That is so Mike Garrison, or that's Ivan, or that's it. Because you hear our voice is so clear in that book, yet we didn't really write much of it. So you can do books without being a great writer.
That's as close as I've ever come. One of my stories is in that book.
Oh, yep. Really? Oh, that's good. Well, you know, I'm trying to get Emil to write, and he gave me permission, Dr. Meisner, to beat on him, which I may have to because he hasn't produced yet. Do I have your permission to beat harder?
Oh, sure. He can take it.
Good. Good. We like that. We like that. Well, I haven't given you a chance to plug how people can be in touch with you if they'd like to purchase your book or learn more about BNI or the Referral Institute. What would you suggest they do?
Well, the website for BNI is BNI.com. If anyone's interested in visiting a BNI group, finding out more about it, we do have 6,200 locations in almost 50 countries around the world, BNI.com. And then the Referral Institute is referralinstitute.com. And Referral Institute is a training company, seminar company, that we're doing what the universities aren't doing. We're teaching people how to build a solid word-of-mouth-based business. And as you know, Emil is the local franchisee in your area.
Mm-hmm.
But we have them all over the world. The book's available at Amazon.com and most major bookstores. We do have a website if somebody wants to get a free chapter of the book just to get a sense of what it's like, businessnetworkingandsex.com. Businessnetworkingandsex.com is our website. Really a blog. We're putting up content that didn't make the book because, I was excited. There were like 500 graphs that came out of these statistical tables, and, you know, I wanted to put 100 of them in, and my co-authors wouldn't let me. There was just too much data. So yeah. I got to put it up on businessnetworkingandsex.com. So if you want to see some stuff that's not in the book, go there.
If you want to see Ivan light up, just put some graphs up. Just
he would like that. That's great. That's great. Well, Dr. Meisner, I thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this morning. And I wish you well on this, and I look forward to your next two books. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you inviting me. If I could leave you with just one last thought,
sure.
I think the most important thing for people to understand about building a powerful personal network is it's not what you know or who you know. It's how well you know them that really counts. It's all about building relationships with other people.
Great. Well, we welcome comments and suggestions about the content and about our guests. Those of you who are listening, if you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. Simply send us an email at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Thank you, Andy, for co-hosting and keeping us on track. Stone, it was great to have you back in the studio. Emil and Betsy, thanks for joining with me. And again, thank you, Dr. Meisner. Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services. You can learn more about Right Choice Services at www.righte-choiceservices.com. And I hope you'll join me next week and tell your friends about the show. Send them an email. Invite them to listen live or listen to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at righthererightnow.businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available usually later in the same day. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business, right here, right now.